And now, for those of you who have, for some reason, found yourselves with nothing else to listen to, we include here the preface to this edition, narrated once again by Dion Graham.
First Vintage Books Edition, February 2001. Copyright 2000-2001 by David, Dave, K. Eggers. All rights reserved, including the right of reproduction in whole or in part in any form. All rights reserved under international and Pan-American copyright conventions published in the United States by Vintage Books, a division of Random House, Inc., New York. Random House is owned in toto by an absolutely huge German company called Bertelsmann AG, which owns too many things to count or track. That said, no matter how big such companies are and how many things they own or how much money they have or make or control, their influence over the daily lives and hearts of individuals, and thus like 99% of what is done by official people in cities like Washington or Moscow or Sao Paulo or Auckland, their effect on the short, fraught lives of human beings who limp around and sleep and dream of flying through bloodstreams, who love the smell of rubber cement and think of space travel while having intercourse, is very, very small, and so hardly worth worrying about. A portion of this book appeared in The New Yorker in a somewhat different form. Originally published in hardcover in slightly different form in the United States by Simon & Schuster, New York, 2000. Vintage Books and Colophon are registered trademarks of Random House, Inc. Manufactured in the United States of America. Height, 5'11", weight, 175, eyes blue, hair brown, hands, chubbier than one would expect, allergies only to dander. Note, this is a work of fiction, only in that, in many cases, the author could not remember the exact words said by certain people and exact descriptions of certain things, so had to fill in gaps as best he could. Otherwise, all characters and incidents and dialogue are real, are not products of the author's imagination, because at the time of this writing, the author had no imagination whatsoever for those sort of things and could not conceive of making up a story or characters. It felt like driving a car in a clown suit, especially when there was so much to say about his own true, sorry, and inspirational story, the actual people that he has known, and of course, the many twists and turns of his own thrilling and complex mind. Any resemblance to persons living or dead should be plainly apparent to them and those who know them, especially if the author has been kind enough to have provided their real names and, in some cases, their phone numbers. All events described herein actually happened, though on occasion the author has taken certain, very small, liberties with chronology, because that is his right as an American. First of all, I am tired. I am true of heart. And also, you are tired. You are true of heart. Rules and suggestions for enjoyment of this book. 1. There is no overwhelming need to read the preface, really. It exists mostly for the author and those who, after finishing the rest of the book, have for some reason found themselves stuck with nothing else to read. If you have already read the preface and wish you had not, we apologize. We should have told you sooner. 2. There is also no overarching need to read the acknowledgments section. Many early readers of this book, see page Roman numeral 45, suggested its curtailment or removal, but they were defied. Still, it is not necessary to the plot in any major way, so, as with the preface, if you have already read the acknowledgments section and wish you had not, again, we apologize. We should have said something. 3. You can also skip the table of contents if you're short of time. 4. Actually, many of you might want to skip much of the middle, namely pages 239 to 351, which concern the lives of people in their early 20s, and those lives are very difficult to make interesting, even when they seemed interesting to those living them at the time. 5. Matter of fact, the first 3 or 4 chapters are all some of you might want to bother with. That gets you to page 123 or so, which is a nice length, a nice novella sort of length. Those first 4 chapters stick to one general subject, something manageable, which is more than what can be said for the book thereafter. 6. The book thereafter is kind of uneven. Preface to this edition. For all the author's bluster elsewhere, this is not actually a work of pure nonfiction. Many parts have been fictionalized in varying degrees for various purposes. Dialogue. This has, of course, been almost entirely reconstructed. The dialogue, though all essentially true, except that which is obviously not true is when people break out of their narrative time-space continuum to cloyingly talk about the book itself, has been written from memory, and reflects both the author's memory's limitations and his imagination's nudgings. All the individual words and sentences have been run through a conveyor, manufactured like so. 1. They are remembered. 2. They are written. 3. They are rewritten, to sound more accurate. 4. They are edited to fit within the narrative, though keeping with their essential truth. 5. They are rewritten again, to spare the author and the other characters the shame of sounding as inarticulate as they invariably do, or would, if their sentences almost invariably begun with the word dude, as in, for example, dude, she died, were merely transcribed. It should be noted, however, that what's remarkable is that the book's most surreal dialogue, like that with the Latino teenagers and that with the beleaguered Jenna, is that which is most true to life. Characters and their characteristics. The author, though he was loath to do it, had to change a few names and further disguise these name-changed characters. The primary example is the character named John, whose real-life name is not actually John because John's real-life counterpart justifiably did not want some of the dark portions of his life chronicled, though after reading the manuscript he did not object to his deeds and words being spoken by another, especially if the character were less a direct facsimile and more of an amalgam, which he is, in fact. Now, to make John work and create a manageable narrative, his alteration had a sort of domino effect, making necessary a few other fictions. Among them, in real life, Meredith Weiss, who is real, does not know John all that well. The person who in real life acted as intermediary was not Meredith, but another person whose presence would give away the connection, indeed, would give away poor John, and we could not have that. Thus, the author called Meredith. Hey. Hey. So, do you mind doing such and such and saying such and such, which in real life you did not actually do and say? No, not at all. So that was that. It should be noted, though, that Meredith's main scene in Chapter 5 contains no fabrications. You can ask her. She lives in Southern California. Otherwise, name changes are addressed in the body of the text. Moving on. Locations and time. First, there have been a few instances of location switching. In Chapter 5, there were two in particular. The conversation with Jenna, wherein the narrator tells her that Toph has fired a gun at his school and then disappeared, did not happen that night in that location, but instead happened in the backseat of a car, traveling from one party to the next on New Year's Eve 1996. Later, in the same chapter, the narrator, with the same Meredith mentioned above, encounters some youths on a San Francisco beach. This episode, though otherwise entirely factual, actually occurred in Los Angeles. Also, in this chapter, as in a few other chapters, there has been compression of time. It is, for the most part, referenced in the text, but we will reiterate here that in the latter third of the book, much happens in what seems to be a short period of time, though most of the events rendered did in fact happen within a very close span of time, a few did not. It should be noted, however, that the following chapters feature no time compression. 1, 2, 4, 7. The title. Yes, the title. The author's father was fond of things like this. Who is the greatest lawyer in the world? He would say, upon leaping into the room after work. And he was probably not the greatest lawyer in the world, but he'd had a good day, and this practice of exalting one's not-so-great achievements with disproportionately grand language became a family tradition. To honor and extend that tradition, this book, the self-flagellating mess of it, has been so named. A note about Columbine. This book was written, and the dialogue it recounts was spoken, many years before the horrific events at that school and elsewhere. No levity is being attached to such things, intentionally or not. Omissions. Some really great sex scenes were omitted, at the request of those who are now married or involved. Also removed was a fantastic scene, 100% true, featuring most of the book's primary characters, and a whale. Further, this edition reflects the omission of a number of sentences, paragraphs, and passages. Among them, page 38, as we lie on the bed, there are only a few long hours when Beth is asleep and Toph is asleep and my mother is asleep. I am awake for much of that time. I like the dark part of the night, after midnight and before 4:30 when it's hollow, when ceilings are harder and farther away. Then I can breathe and can think while others are sleeping in a way, can stop time, can have it so. This has always been my dream, so that while everyone else is frozen, I can work busily about them, doing whatever it is that needs to be done, like the elves who make the shoes while the children sleep. As I lie, drenched in the amber room, I wonder if I will nap in the morning. I think I can believe I can sleep from maybe 5 until 10 before the nurses start coming in, adjusting and wiping, and so I'm content to stay up. But this hide-a-bed is killing me. The flimsiness of the mattress, the way that bar is digging into my back, bisecting my spine, grinding into it, toe turning, kicking, and on the other side of the room, her uneven breathing. Page 126. How do you handle this? Bill is up visiting, and he and Topher and I are driving over the Bay Bridge, and we are talking about stock brokering. We are talking about how, after Toph spent a weekend in Manhattan Beach with Bill and Bill's two stockbroker roommates, Toph now wants to be a stockbroker too. Bill is so excited about it all, he can hardly stand it. Wants to buy him a pair of suspenders, a starter-sized ticker. We were thinking that, with Toph so good with numbers and all, that something like that would be a perfect career. I almost drive the car off the bridge. Page 197. Why the scaffolding? See, I like the scaffolding. I like the scaffolding as much as I like the building, especially if that scaffolding is beautiful in its way. Page 207. Alcoholism and death make you omnivorous, both reckless and afraid, amoral, desperate. Do you really believe that? Sometimes. Sure. No. Yes. Page 217. But see, in high school, I did a series of paintings of members of my family. The first was of Toph, from a photograph I had taken, because for the assignment we were required to grid the picture out for accuracy. The painting, in tempera, was dead on. It looked just like him. Not so with the rest of them, without aid of a picture under a grid. I did one of Bill, but his face came out too rigid, his eyes too dark, and his hair looked matted, Caesar-like, which was not at all the case in real life. The painting of Beth, from a photograph of her dressed for the prom, was off, too, all blood-red flesh under pink taffeta. I abandoned it right away. The one of my mom and dad, from an old slide, showed them on a boat together on a gray day. My mother takes up most of the frame, facing the camera, while my dad is over her shoulder at the front of the boat, looking off to the side, unaware a picture is being taken, or feigning same. I screwed that one up, too. Couldn't get the likenesses. Anytime one of them would see one of the paintings, they hated them. Bill was incensed when the one of him was shown at the public library. Is that legal? He demanded of my father, the lawyer. Can he even do that? I look like a monster. And he was right. He did. So during my junior year, when Ricky Storr asked me to do a portrait of his father, I hesitated because I had been so repeatedly frustrated by my limits, by my inability to render someone without distorting them, clumsily, horribly. But to Ricky, I said yes, out of respect, thrilled in a way that he had bestowed the honor on me with the painting of a memorial for his father. So Ricky provided a formal black-and-white photograph, and I worked at it for weeks with tiny brushes. When I was done, the likeness, to me, was unassailable. I told Ricky to come to the school's art room, that it was ready. He finished his lunch early one day and came down. I turned it around with a flourish, with great pride, ready for us both to glow in its presence. There was quiet. Then he said, "Oh. Oh. That's not what I expected. That's not what I expected." Then he left the room, and the painting with me. Page 217. When we would drive past a cemetery, we would click our tongues and marvel, unbelieving. Especially the big ones. The crowded one, obscene places, so few trees, all that gray, like some sort of monstrous ashtray. When we went by, Toph could not look. And I looked only to know, to reconfirm my own promise, that I would never be in such a place, would never bury anyone in such a place. Who were these graves for? Who did they comfort? Would never allow myself to be buried in such a place, that I would either disappear completely. I have visions of my demise, when I know I have only so much more time left. For example, if I do in fact have AIDS, as I believe I probably do, if anyone does, it's me, why not? When the time comes, I will just leave, say goodbye, and leave, and then throw myself into a volcano. Not that there seems to be any appropriate place to bury someone, but These municipal cemeteries, or any cemetery at all for that matter, like the ones by the highway or the ones in the middle of town with all these bodies with their corresponding rocks, oh, it's just too primitive and vulgar, isn't it? The hole in the box and the rock on the grass. And we glamorize this process, feel it fitting and dramatic, austerely beautiful, standing there by the hole as we lower the box. It's incredible, barbaric and base. Though I should say I once saw a place that seemed fitting. I was walking, I would say hiking, if I were doing anything but walking, but since we were just walking, I will not use the word hiking, which everyone feels compelled to use anytime they're outside and there's a slight incline, in a forest above the Carapa, a tributary of the Amazon. I was on a junket with a few other journalists, two from Reptile Magazine, and a group of herpetologists, a bunch of chubby American snake experts with cameras, and we had been brought through this forest on an upward meandering path, looking for boa constrictors and lizards. After maybe 45 minutes under this dappled, dark forest, suddenly the trees broke, and we were at the top of the trail, in a clearing, over the river. And at that point, you could see for honestly 100 miles. The sun was setting, and in that huge Amazonian sky, there were washes of blue and orange, thick swashes of each, mixed loosely like paint pushed with fingers. The river was moving slowly below, the color of caramel, and beyond it was the forest, the jungle, green broccoli chaos as far as you could see. And immediately before us, there were about 20 simple white crosses, without anything in the way of markings. A burial ground for local villagers. And it occurred to me that I could stay there. That if I had to be buried, my rotting corpse heaped on with dirt, I could stand to have it done there, with the view and all. It was odd timing, too, because earlier that day, I was almost sure I was leaving this world, via Piranha. We had anchored our boat, a 3-story riverboat in a small river cul-de-sac, and the guides had begun fishing for piranha, using only sticks and string, chicken as bait. The piranhas took to it immediately. It was a cinch. They were jumping onto the boat, flopping around with their furious little faces. And then, on the other side of the boat, our American guide, a bearded Bill, was swimming. The water, like tea, made his underwater limbs appear red, making all the more disconcerting the fact that he was swimming amid a school of piranhas. "Come in," he said. Oh, God, no way. Then everyone else was in. The chubby herpetologists were in, all their limbs in the blood-red tea. I had been told that piranha attacks were extremely rare, though not unheard of, that there was nothing to fear, and so soon enough I jumped from the boat and was swimming too, relatively content that even if there was some feeding frenzy, at least my odds were better than if I were in the water alone. While the fish were gorging on someone else, I'd have time to swim to safety. I actually did the math of how long it would take the fish to eat the other 4 people vis-a-vis how long I'd have to get to the riverbank. After about 3 or 4 minutes, each one panic-stricken, trying not to touch my feet to the muddy ground, keeping my movements minimal so as not to attract attention, I got out. Later, I tried out one of the guide's dugout canoes. After a few of the herpetologists had failed to stay afloat in it, I was convinced that I, being so very agile, could paddle and keep it afloat. I got in the tiny canoe, steadied myself, and paddled away. And for a while, I did it. I set off from the main boat, downriver, alternating sides with the small paddle, the very picture of skill and grace. But about 200 yards down the river, the canoe began to sink. I was too heavy. It was taking in water. I looked back to the boat. The Peruvian guides were all watching, were hysterical. I was sinking into the brown water, the current taking me farther downstream, and they were laughing, doubled over. They were loving it. The canoe tipped, and I fell in. At this point, in the middle of the river, where it was much deeper, a darker shade of brown, I could not see my limbs. I climbed onto the capsized canoe, desperate. I was sure I was gone. Yes, the piranhas over there by the main boat had not touched us, but how could you be sure that out here, that they wouldn't take a nip from a finger? They often nipped fingers and toes, and that would draw blood, and from there... Oh, God, Toph. I was there, and the canoe was sinking again, capsized but sinking under my weight, and soon I would be wholly in this river again, the river infested with piranhas, and my thrashing would draw them to me. I was trying to keep it to a minimum, just kicking my legs, staying afloat. And then I would be picked at slowly, chunks from my calves and stomach. Then, once the flesh was torn and blood ribboning out, there would be the flurry, 100 at once. I would look down and see my extremities overcome by a terrible blur of teeth and blood, and I would be picked clean to the bone. And why? Because I had to show the entourage that I could do whatever any Peruvian river guide could do. And I thought of poor Toph, this poor boy, 3,000 miles away, staying with my sister. How could I leave him? Page 218. My mother read a horror novel every night. She had read every one in the library. When birthdays and Christmas would come, I would consider buying her a new one, the latest Dean R. Kuntz or Stephen King or whatever, but I couldn't. I didn't want to encourage her. I couldn't touch my father's cigarettes, couldn't look at the Pall Mall cartons in the pantry. I was the sort of child who couldn't even watch commercials for horror movies. The ad for Magic, the movie where the marionette kills people, sent me into a 6-month nightmare frenzy. So I couldn't look at her books, would turn them over so their covers wouldn't show, the raised lettering and splotches of blood, especially the V.C. Andrews oeuvre, those turgid pictures of those terrible kids standing so still, all lit in blue. Page 414. Bill and Beth and Toph and I are watching the news. There is a small item about George Bush's grandmother. It is apparently her birthday. We debate about how old the grandmother of a man in his late 60s must be. It seems impossible that she's still breathing. Beth changes the channel. That's disgusting, she says. Page 427. She was living in a sort of perpetual present. Always she had to be told of her context, what brought her here, the origins and parameters of her current situation. Dozens of times each day, she had to be told everything again. What made me? Whose fault am I? How did I get here? Who are these people? The accident recounted, sketched in broad strokes, her continuously reminded, but always forgetting. Not forgetting, having actually no capacity to grip the information. But who does? Fuck it, she was alive and she knew it. Her voice sang the same way it always did. Her eyes bulged with amazement over the smallest things. Anything. My haircut. Yes, she still knew and had access to those things that had been with her for years. That part of her memory was there, intact. And while I wanted to punish those responsible, would relish it and presume that I would never tire of it, being with her, so close to her skin and the blood rushing beneath it, drains me of hatred. The music from the pool changed. Oh, I like this song, she said, doing a zigzag with her neck. Finally, this edition reflects the author's request that all previous epigraphs, including The Heart's Immortal Thirst to Be Completely Known and All Forgiven, H. Van Dyke, My Poems May Hurt the Dead, But the Dead Belong to Me, A. Sexton, Not Every Boy Thrown to the Wolves Becomes a Hero, J. Barth, Everything Will Be Forgotten and Nothing Will Be Redressed, M. Kundera, Why Not Just Write What Happened? R. Lowell. Oh, look at me, I'm Dave, I'm writing a book with all my thoughts in it, la la la. Christopher Eggers. Be removed, as he never really saw himself as the type of person who would use epigraphs. August 1999. Contents. Part 1. Through the small, tall bathroom window, etc. Part 2. Please look. Can you see us? Etc. Part 3. The enemies list, etc. Part 4. Oh, I could be going out, sure. Part 5. Outside it's blue-black and getting darker, etc. Part 6. When we hear the news at first. Part 7. Fuck it, stupid show, etc. Part 8. We can't do anything about the excrement. Part 9. Robert Urich says no, we were so close. Part 10. Of course it's cold. Part 11. Black Sands Beach is... Acknowledgements. The author wishes first and foremost to acknowledge his friends at NASA and the United States Marine Corps for their great support and unquantifiable help with the technical aspects of this story. Les saludo, muchachos. He wishes also to acknowledge the many people who have stretched the meaning of generosity by allowing their real names and actions to appear in this book. This goes doubly for the author's siblings, especially his sister Beth, whose memories were in most places more vivid, and triply for Toph, pronounced Toph, long O, for obvious reasons. His older brother Bill is not being singled out because he is a Republican. The author would like to acknowledge that he does not look good in red, or pink, or orange, or even yellow. He is not a spring. And until last year, he thought Evelyn Waugh was a woman, and that George Eliot was a man. Further, the author and those behind the making of this book wish to acknowledge that, yes, there are perhaps too many memoir sorts of books being written at this juncture, and that such books about real things and real people, as opposed to kind of made-up things and people, are inherently vile and corrupt and wrong and evil and bad, but would like to remind everyone that we could all do worse as readers and as writers. Anecdote. Midway through the writing of this memoir, an acquaintance of the author's accosted him at a Western-themed restaurant/bar while the author was eating a hearty plate of ribs and potatoes served fried in the French style. The accoster sat down opposite, asking what was new, what was up, what he was working on, etc. The author said, oh, well, then he was kind of working on a book, kind of mumble-mumble. Oh, great, said the acquaintance, who was wearing a sport coat made from what seemed to be, but it might have been the light, purple velour. What kind of book? Asked the acquaintance. Let's call him, Oswald. What's it about? Asked Oswald. Well, said the author, again with the silver tongue, it's kind of hard to explain. I guess it's kind of a memoir-y kind of thing. Oh, no, said Oswald, interrupting him loudly. Oswald's hair, you might want to know, was feathered. Don't tell me you've fallen into that trap. It tumbled down his shoulders, Dungeons and Dragons style. Memoir? Come on, don't pull that old trick, man. He went on like this for a while, using the colloquial language of the day, until, well, the author felt sort of bad. After all, maybe Oswald, with the purple velour and the brown corduroys, was right. Maybe memoirs were bad. Maybe writing about actual events in the first person, if not from Ireland and before you turned 70, was bad. He had a point. Hoping to change the subject, the author asked Oswald, who shares a surname with the man who killed a president, what it was that he was working on. Oswald was some sort of professional writer. The author, of course, was both expecting and dreading that Oswald's project would be of grave importance and grand scope, a renunciation of Keynesian economics, a reworking of Grendel, this time from the point of view of nearby conifers, whatever. But do you know what he said? He of the feathered hair and purple velour? What he said was, a screenplay. He didn't italicize it then, but we will hear, a screenplay. What sort of screenplay? The author asked, having no overarching problem with screenplays, liking movies enormously and all, how they held a mirror to our violent society and all, but suddenly feeling slightly better all the same. The answer, a screenplay about William S. Burroughs and the drug culture. Well, suddenly the clouds broke, the sun shone, and once again the author knew this, that even if the idea of relating a true story is a bad idea, and even if the idea of writing about deaths in the family and delusions as a result is unappealing to everyone but the author's high school classmates and a few creative writing students in New Mexico, there are still ideas that are much, much worse. Besides, if you are bothered by the idea of this being real, you are invited to do what the author should have done, and what authors and readers have been doing since the beginning of time. Pretend it's fiction. As a matter of fact, the author would like to make an offer. For those of you on the side of Oswald, he will do this. If you send in your copy of this book, in hardcover or paperback, he will send you, for a fee of $10, make checkout to D. Eggers, a 3.5-inch floppy disk, on which will be a complete digital manuscript of this work, albeit with all names and locations changed in such a way that the only people who will know who is who are those whose lives have been included, though thinly disguised. Voila! Fiction! Further, the digital version will be interactive, as we expect our digital things to be. Hey, have you heard of these new molecule-sized microchips? The ones that can do, like, all the functions ever performed by all computers since the beginning of time in 1 second in a grain of salt? Can you believe that? Well, it's as true now as ever. Technology is changing the way we live. About the digital version, for starters, you'll have the option of choosing the protagonist's name. We'll provide dozens of suggestions, including the writer, the author, the journalist, and Paul Theroux. Or you can go it alone and make up your own. Matter of fact, using the search and replace function your computer surely features, readers should be able to change all the names within, from the main characters down to the smallest cameos. This can be about you, you and your pals. Those interested in this fictional version of this book should send their books to AHWOSG, Special Offer for Fiction Preferers, care of Vintage Books, 299 Park Avenue, New York, New York, 10171. Note, this offer is real. Although, books sent in, unfortunately, cannot be returned. Instead, they will be remaindered with the rest. Moving on, the author wishes to acknowledge the existence of a planet just beyond Pluto, and further wishes, on the basis of his own casual research and faith, to reassert Pluto's planethood. Why did we do that to Pluto? We had it good with Pluto. The author wishes to acknowledge that because this book is occasionally ha-ha, you are permitted to dismiss it. The author wishes to acknowledge your problems with the title. He too has reservations. The title you see on the cover was a winner of a round-robin sort of title tourney held outside Phoenix, Arizona over a long weekend in December 1998. The other contenders, with reasons for failure, a heartbreaking work of death and embarrassment. True, but unappealing. An astounding work of courage and strength. Stephen Ambrose would have cause for action. Memories of a Catholic Boyhood, also taken, more or less. And Old and Black in America. Risqué, some say. We preferred the last one, alluding as it does to both aging and an American sort of otherness, but it was dismissed out of hand by the publisher, leaving us with a heartbreaking work of staggering genius. Yes, it caught your eye. First you took it at face value and picked it up immediately. This is just the sort of book for which I have been looking. Many of you, particularly those among you who seek out the maudlin and melodramatic, were struck by the heartbreaking part. Others thought the staggering genius element seemed like a pretty good recommendation. But then you thought, hey, can these two elements work together? Or might they be like peanut butter and chocolate, plaid and paisley, never to peacefully coexist? Like, if this book is indeed heartbreaking, then why spoil the mood with the puffery? Or if the title is some elaborate joke, then why make an attempt at sentiment? Which is to say nothing of the foe. Real? No, you beg, please, no. Boastfulness of the whole title put together. In the end, one's only logical interpretation of the title's intent is as A, a cheap kind of joke, B, buttressed by an interest in lamely executed titular innovation, employed, one suspects, only to shock, which is C, undermined, of course, by the cheap joke aspect, and D, confused by the creeping feeling one gets that the author is dead serious in his feeling that the title is an accurate description of the content, intent, and quality of the book. Oh, pshaw. Does it even matter now? Hells no! You're here! You're in! We're having a party! The author would like to acknowledge that he did, indeed, vote for Ross Perot in 1996 and is not the least ashamed about it because he is an ardent fan of the rich and insane, particularly when their hearts bleed, which Mr. Perot's does. It really does. On a different note, the author feels obligated to acknowledge that, yes, the success of a memoir, of any book, really, has a lot to do with how appealing its narrator is. To address this, the author offers the following. A. That he is like you. B. That, like you, he falls asleep shortly after he becomes drunk. C. That he sometimes has sex without condoms. D. That he sometimes falls asleep when he is drunk having sex without condoms. E. That he never gave his parents a proper burial. F. That he never finished college. G. That he expects to die young. H. That, because his father smoked and drank and died as a result, he is afraid of food. I, that he smiles when he sees young black men holding babies. One word, appealing, and that's just the beginning. Now, the author also wishes to acknowledge the major themes of this book. They are, A, the unspoken magic of parental disappearance. It is every child's and teen's dream. Sometimes it is born of bitterness. Sometimes it is born of self-pity. Sometimes one wants attention. Usually all three factors play a part. The point is that everyone at one point or another daydreams about their parents dying and about what it would be like to be an orphan, like Annie or Pippi Longstocking or, more recently, the beautiful tragic naifs of Party of Five. One pictures in place of the love perhaps unpredictably given and more often withheld by one's parents that, in their absence, that love and attention would be lavished upon them, that the townspeople, one's relatives, one's friends and teachers, the world around would suddenly be swept up in sympathy and fascination for the orphaned child, that his or her life would be one of celebrity mixed with pathos, fame sprung from tragedy, the best kind by far. Most daydream it, some live it, and this aspect of the book will intimate that just as it was in Pippi, it is in real life. Thus, an incomparable loss begets both constant struggle and heart-hardening, but also some unimpeachable rewards, starting with absolute freedom, interpretable and of use in a number of ways. And though it seems inconceivable to lose both parents in the space of 32 days, there was that line from The Imp of Being Earnest,
"To have lost one parent, Mr. Worthing, might be considered a misfortune. To have lost both smacks of carelessness."
And to lose them to completely different diseases, cancer sure, but different enough in terms of location, duration, and provenance. That loss is accompanied by an undeniable but then, of course, guilt-inducing sense of mobility, of infinite possibility, having suddenly found oneself in a world with neither floor nor ceiling. B. The brotherly love / weird symbiosis factor. This thread will be going throughout and was, as a matter of fact, supposed to be the surprise conclusion reached at the end of the book, the big payoff, as it were, that while the author searches for love, there will be some episodes involving that, and his brother searches for, you know, whatever little kids search for, gum and pennies, and together they try to be normal and happy, they actually will probably always be unsuccessful in any and every extracurricular relationship, given that the only people who they truly admire and love and find perfect are each other. C. The painfully, endlessly self-conscious book aspect. This is probably obvious enough already. The point is, the author doesn't have the energy or, more important, skill to fib about this being anything other than him telling you about things and is not a good enough liar to do it in any competently sublimated narrative way. At the same time, he will be clear and upfront about this being a self-conscious memoir, which you may come to appreciate, and which is the next theme. C.2, the knowingness about the book's self-consciousness aspect. While the author is self-conscious about being self-referential, he is also knowing about that self-conscious self-referentiality. Further, and if you're one of those people who can tell what's going to happen before it actually happens, you've predicted the next element here. He also plans to be clearly, obviously aware of his knowingness about his self-consciousness of self-referentiality. Further, he is fully cognizant, way ahead of you, in terms of knowing about and fully admitting the gimmickry inherent in all this, and will preempt your claim of the book's irrelevance due to said gimmickry by saying that the gimmickry is simply a device, a defense, to obscure the black, blinding, murderous rage and sorrow at the core of this whole story, which is both too black and blinding to look at.
Avert your eyes.
But nevertheless useful, at least to the author, even in caricatured or condensed form, because telling as many people as possible about it helps, he thinks, to dilute the pain and bitterness and thus facilitate its flushing from his soul, the pursuit of which is the basis of the next cluster of themes. D. The telling the world of suffering as means of flushing or at least diluting of pain aspect. For example, the author spent some time later relating his unsuccessful, though just barely unsuccessful, attempt to become a cast member of The Real World in 1994, when the show's third season was being filmed in San Francisco. At that point, the author sought to do two related things. One, to purge himself of his past by trumpeting his recent life's events to the world, and thus, by spreading his pain, his heartbreaking story, to the show's thousands or millions of watchers, he would receive in turn 1,000 tidal waves of sympathy and support, and never be lonely again. And two, to become well-known for his sorrows, or at least to let his suffering facilitate his becoming well-known, while at the same time not shrinking from the admission of such manipulations of his pain for profit, because the admission of such motivations, at least in his opinion, immediately absolves him of responsibility for such manipulations, implications, or consequences, because being aware of and open about one's motives at least means one is not lying, and no one, except an electorate, likes a liar. We all like full disclosure, particularly if it includes the admission of one's, one, mortality, and two, propensity to fail, related but not the same. E. The putting this all down as tool for stopping time, given the overlap with fear of death aspect, and E's self-explanatory corollary, E.2, in addition to putting this down as tool for stopping time, the sexual rendezvous with old friends or grade school crushes as tool for collapsing of time and vindication of self-worth? F. the part where the author either exploits or exalts his parents, depending on your point of view. G, the unmistakable feeling one gets after something truly weird or extraordinarily weird or weirdly terrible happens to them, that, in a way, they have been chosen aspect. This, of course, happened to the author. After the double deaths and his guardianship, he felt suddenly watched. He could not help but think, in much the same way someone who had been struck by lightning might, that he had somehow been singled out and that his life was thereafter charged with purpose, with the gravest importance, that he could not be wasting time, that he must act in accordance with his destiny, that it was so plainly obvious that he had been chosen to lead. H. The aspect having to do with, perhaps, inherited fatalism. This part concerns the unshakable feeling one gets, one thinks, after the unthinkable and unexplainable happens. The feeling that if this person can die, and that person can die, and this can happen, and that can happen, well then, what exactly is preventing everything from happening to this person? He around whom everything else happened. If people are dying, why won't he? If people are shooting people from cars, if people are tossing rocks down from overpasses, surely he will be the next victim. If people are contracting AIDS, odds are he will too. Same with fires in homes, car accidents, plane crashes, random knifings, stray gunfire, aneurysms, spider bites, snipers, piranhas, zoo animals. It's the confluence of the self-centeredness discussed in G, and a black sort of outlook one is handed when all rules of impossibility and propriety are thrown out. Thus, one starts to feeling that death is literally around each and every corner, and more specifically, in every elevator. Even more literally, that each and every time an elevator door opens, there will be standing, in a trench coat, a man with a gun who will fire one bullet straight into him, killing him instantly and deservedly, both in keeping with his role as the object of so much wrath in general and for his innumerable sins, both Catholic and karmic. Just as some police, particularly those they dramatize on television, might be familiar with death, and might expect it at any instant, not necessarily their own, but death generally. So does the author, possessing a naturally paranoid disposition, compounded by environmental factors that make it seem not only possible, but probable, that whatever there might be out there that snuffs out life is probably sniffing around for him, that his number is perennially, eternally up, that his draft number is low, that his bingo card is hot, that he has a bullseye on his chest and target on his back. It's fun. You'll see. And finally, I, the memoir as act of self-destruction aspect. It can and should be the shedding of a skin, which is something one should do, as necessary and invigorating as the occasional facial or colonic. Revelation is everything, not for its own sake, because most self-revelation is just garbage. Oop. Yes, but we have to purge the garbage, toss it out, throw it into a bunker and burn it, because it is fuel. It's fossil fuel. And what do we do with fossil fuel? Why, we dump it into a bunker and burn it, of course. No, we don't do that. But you get my meaning. It's endlessly renewable, usable without diminishing one's capacity to create more. The author falls asleep shortly after he becomes drunk. The author has sex without condoms. The author falls asleep when he's drunk having sex without condoms. There. That's something. You have something. But what do you have? I point two. The easy and unconvincing nihilistic poserism regarding full disclosure of one's secrets and pain, passing it off under a semi-high-minded guise when in fact the author is himself very private about many or most matters, though he sees the use in making certain facts and happenings public. I point three. The fact that below, or maybe next to, the self-righteousness and the self-hatred is a certain hope, instilled far before any of this happened. There will also be these threads, which are all more or less self-explanatory. J, the flouting of sublimation as evidence of enforced solipsism aspect. K, the solipsism as likely result of economic, historical, and geopolitical privilege aspect. L, the TOEFF dialectic, he serving as both inspiration for and impediment to writing of memoir. M, the TOEFF dialectic 2, he serving as both magnet and, when the need arises, wedge vis-a-vis relations with women. Similarly, N, The parental loss dialectic, in terms of that factor lending itself well to situations necessitating the garnering of sympathy and also to those requiring a quick exit. Not to mention, O, the aspect concerning the unavoidability, given the situation with brother, of near constant poignance. P, the self-aggrandizement as art form aspect. Q, the self-flagellation as art form aspect. R, the self-aggrandizement disguised as self-flagellation as even higher art form aspect. S, the self-canonization disguised as self-destruction masquerading as self-aggrandizement disguised as self-flagellation as highest art form of all aspect. T, the search for support, a sense of community, if you will, in one's peers, in those one's age, after one looks around and realizes that all others, all those older, are either dead or perhaps should be, aspect. U, the fact that T dovetails quite nicely with G, aspect. Or in graph form, sorta. The deaths, leading to much thinking about the triumph of human spirit, leading to, in particular, the incredible triumph and rise of the Eggers brothers, also, in general, the triumph of at least potential of youth and its preferentiality over the aged and infirm, leading to wanting to save friends and peers from dying quietly, leading to needing, in lieu of extended family, his idea of community from peers, etc. And going back to the top, the deaths, also leading to much thinking about the inevitability of decay and early and random death and the short life of anything real or beautiful, leading to, in wake of loss, desperate attempts to hold things together, also leading to carelessness born of hopelessness, but going back to the other one, leading to constant contact with grade school friends, leading to, due to environmental factors and upbringing, innate sense that ideas of community are silly and soft, etc. Also, going back up to carelessness born of hopelessness, sometime failure to use condoms, leading to frequent carnal contact with grade school friends, leading to convenient belief that sexual contact with peers and grade school friends strengthens this idea of community, etc. And these are all variously connected. The author would also like to acknowledge what he was paid to write this book. Total, gross, $100,000. Deductions, agent's fee, 15%, $15,000. Taxes, after agent's fee, $23,800. Expenses related to production of book, portion of rent, 2 years, between $600 and $1,500 monthly, approximately $12,000. Trip to Chicago, research, $850. Trip to San Francisco, research, $620. Food, consumed while ostensibly writing, $5,800. Sundries, $1,200. Laser printer, $600. Paper, $242. Postage, to send manuscript for approval to siblings Beth, somewhere in Northern California, and Bill, an advisor to the controller of Texas in Austin. Kirsten, San Francisco, married. Chalini, living at home in L.A., doing well. Meredith Weiss, freelance wardrobe stylist, San Diego. Jamie Carrick, in L.A., part of management team for Hanson, a popular music outfit. Ricky, San Francisco, investment banker, high-tech IPOs, etc., etc. $231. Copy of Xanadu original movie soundtrack, $14.32. Information retrieval service, unsuccessful attempt to retrieve 2 years' worth of journal entries from external hard drive, expired, $75. Net total, $39,567.68. Which still isn't so bad, come to think of it. More than the author, who is not a pet owner, can spend. Therefore, he pledges some of it to you, or at least some of you. The first 200 readers of this book who write with proof that they have read and absorbed the many lessons herein will each receive a check from the author for $5 drawn from a U.S. bank, probably Chase Manhattan, which is not a good bank. Do not open an account there. Now, how to prove that you have bought and read the book? Let's say we do this. Take the book, which you are required to have purchased. It should go without saying that if you have checked this book out from the library or are reading it in paperback, you are much, much too late. Come to think of it, you may be reading this far, far in the future. It's probably being taught in all the schools. Do tell, what's it like in the future? Is everyone wearing robes? Are the cars rounder or less round? Is there a women's soccer league yet? Enclose your receipt, or a copy of the receipt, and have someone take a picture of you reading the book or maybe putting it to better use. Special consideration for A, the inclusion in the picture of a baby or babies, as everyone knows that babies are nice. B, the inclusion in the picture of a baby with an exceptionally large tongue. C, pictures taken in exotic locales, with the book, remember. D, pictures of the book being rubbed against by a red panda, a small bear, plus raccoon-looking mammal, also known as the lesser panda, native of central China, and frequent rubber againster of things for marking of territory. Do not forget to center yourself or whatever your subject in the picture. If you're using an autofocus camera with a 35mm lens, get closer than you feel you should. The lens, because it's convex, has the effect of backing you up 5 to 8 feet. Also, keep your clothes on, please. Those readers who are savvy enough to have picked up a copy of one quarterly publication in particular will already know the most expeditious address to receive this freeish money, though that address is only good until maybe August 2000, and will therefore be at an advantage, time-wise. Otherwise, send your tasteful photographs to AHWOSG Offer, Vintage Books, 299 Park Avenue, New York, New York, 10171. If, by the time the author receives your letter, he has already distributed the 200 checks, good fortune may yet strike. If your picture is amusing or your name or hometown unfortunate sounding and you include a self-addressed stamped envelope, he will put something, not money, inside the envelope and will send it back, because he does not have cable and needs diversion. Now, interesting story. My father once related how he and his friend Les had come up with a way when stalling for time in a meeting or a deposition, he and Les were lawyers. Les, alive and well, still is a lawyer. Instead of saying or one could say now, a word which accomplishes two things. It serves the same stalling purpose as or but instead of being dumb-sounding off-putting, it creates suspense for what is coming next, whatever that might be, that which the speaker doesn't yet know. The author would like to acknowledge your desire to get started with the plot, the body of the book, the story. He will do that. And contrary to what was said in D, he will be giving you, for a good 100 pages or so, uninterrupted, unselfconscious prose, which will entertain and make sad and, here and there, hearten. He will get on with that story any moment now, because he recognizes when the time has come, when the time is right, when the getting's good. He acknowledges the needs and feelings of a reader, the fact that a reader only has so much time, so much patience. That seemingly endless screwing about, interminable clearing of one's throat, can very easily look like, or even become, a sort of contemptuous stalling, a putting off of one's readers, and no one wants that. Or do they? So we will move on, because the author, like you, wants to move on, into the meat of it, dive right in and revisit this stuff, because it's a story that ought to be told, involving, as it does, death and redemption, bile and betrayal. So dive in we will, after a few more acknowledgments. The author would like to acknowledge the brave men and women serving in the United States Armed Forces. He wishes them well and hopes they come home soon. That is, if they want to. If they like it where they are, he hopes they stay there, at least until such time as they want to come home. Then they should come straight home, on the very next plane. The author would also like to acknowledge the makers of comic book villains and superheroes, those who invented, or at least popularized, the notion of the normal, mild-mannered person transformed into mutant by freak accident, with the mutant thereafter driven by a strange hybrid of the most rancid bitterness and the most outrageous hope to do very, very odd and silly things, many times in the name of good. The makers of comic books seem to be onto something there. Now, in a spirit of interpretive glasnost, the author would like to save you trouble by laying out a rough guide to a little over half of the metaphors in the book. The sun equals mother. Moon equals father. Family room equals the past. Nosebleed equals decay. Tumor equals portent. Sky equals emancipation. Ocean equals mortality. Bridge equals bridge. Wallet equals security, father, past, and class. Lattice equals transcendental equivalent. White bed equals womb. Furniture, rugs, etc. equals the past. Tiny stuffed bear equals mother. Toaf equals mother. Dolls equals mother. Lake Michigan equals mother, past, peace, chaos, the unknown. Mother equals mortality. Mother equals love. Mother equals rage. Mother equals cancer. Nancy equals the past. John equals father. Shalini equals promise. Sky equals promise. Me equals mother. Note, no symbolism is meant by the use of journeys any way you want it. The author would also like to acknowledge his propensity to exaggerate, and his propensity to fib in order to make himself look better, or worse, whichever serves his purposes at the time. He would also like to acknowledge that, no, he is not the only person to ever lose his parents, and that he is also not the only person ever to lose his parents and inherit a youngster. But he would like to point out that he is currently the only such person with a book contract. He would like to acknowledge the distinguished senator from Massachusetts and Palestinian statehood, and the implicit logic of the instant replay rule. And that he, too, is well aware of all of the book's flaws and shortcomings, whatever you consider them to be, and that he tips his hat to you for noticing them. And come to think of it, he would actually like to acknowledge his brother Bill, after all. His brother Bill is such a good man, and this book's gracious and trusting editor, Jeff Klosky, and Mr. Klosky's assistant, Nicole Grave, who has her vowels transposed but is otherwise very nice, also C. Leishen, A. Quinn, J. Leatham, and V. Vida for the assuaging of fears, not to mention Adrian Miller, John Warner, Marnie Requa, and Sarah Val, whose readings of this book before it was readable were much appreciated, even though, come to think of it, the author did toss Warner $100, which makes his acknowledgement kind of unnecessary. And once again, all the people who star in this story, especially Mr. CME, who knows who he is. Finally, the author would also like to acknowledge the men and women of the United States Postal Service for performing a sometimes thankless task with great aplomb and, given the scale and scope of the endeavor, with stunning efficiency.
That was the preface to this edition of A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius by Dave Eggers, narrated by Dion Graham. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Let the Great World Spin by Colm McCann, narrated by the Recorded Books Repertory Company. In the dawning light of a late summer morning, the people of Lower Manhattan stand hushed, staring up in disbelief at the Twin Towers. It is August 1974, and a mysterious tightrope walker is running, dancing, leaping between the towers, suspended a quarter mile above the ground. In the streets below, a slew of ordinary lives become extraordinary in Colm McCann's stunningly intricate portrait of a city and its people, winner of the 2009 National Book Award. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. Call us toll-free or log on to recordedbooks.com to learn about our latest releases and special offers, order another recorded book, or to read author interviews and narrator profiles. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.